Market.
The S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that thinks two's company, but three's a crowd, but nevertheless has a special guest this week. I'm Andrew Page, and with me, as always, is Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools.
And a third wheel, could I say,
well,
Scott?
Well, kind of a third wheel. Four. Well, Liam's here as well, so we've got four in the
four,
room.
Four, of course.
So we can pair up nicely if we need to, you know, go double date. We can do that later.
We'll hold the intros just for one second. Let's talk a bit about what we're
keep
talking
in
about
suspenders
today. All right. Firstly, I say this every week, we just can't get away from this damn topic. We're going to talk a bit about Bitcoin.
You say it like it's a bad thing.
It's a love-hate relationship, Mr. Phillips.
You love to hate it and I hate to love it.
Exactly. And our favorite octogenarian has weighed in on the topic. Warren Buffett himself has given a few thoughts on Bitcoin. So because it aligns with my thinking, I thought, hell, let's talk about that. Add a bit of credibility to the argument.
Not only that, but there's some new coins coming out.
There are some new coins.
Don't give it away.
There's only 1,000 of them out there, so why not add another type of crypto?
There you go.
So we'll talk a bit about that as well. But we also want to sort of pivot this into something perhaps a little bit more valuable than just us waxing lyrical about the same old stuff. And perhaps talk about some of the behavioral biases that are at play. The Bitcoin's behaving badly. What can that tell us about other types of investments?
Good call.
And we want to talk a bit about valuation. We got a really good question recently, a bit about, you know, how do I think about valuation? Mm-hmm. You guys tend to talk about that a lot. Let's go through some practical steps. Hence, our guest today.
A very special guest.
Well,
there he is.
Well, there. Can you guess?
Hey, we can do like a secret voice thing. That's very FM, Liam. Can we do that?
It is none other than...
Not without a bit more of a heads up.
No. We've got none other than Mr. Matt Joss himself. From our sister service within the Motley Fool.
Indeed.
TMF Pro, Motley Fool Pro. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
We are going to get you to weigh in and use that massive intellect of yours to to educate our listeners and put Scott and I to shame, which frankly is not going to be too hard.
The good thing is by adding Matt to the room, he's actually double the IQ.
The average IQ has just gone way up. But first. Okay.
Ooh. And the only reason I'm doing a but first is I do want to pay a little bit of a tribute to our colleague, Mike King, who passed away this week. Yeah. Many of our listeners won't know Mike. He hasn't been a guest on this podcast. Mike suffered a year-long battle with cancer and did pass away this week. So wanted to pay tribute to Mike. Remember him and go well, Kinger.
One of the good guys, right?
Indeed.
Just fantastic. Yeah, well said, mate.
Thank you, sir.
Bitcoin. Warren Buffett, everyone knows, has come out and he's made a few comments on that. And so one of the things he said is, I can say almost with certainty that they will come to a bad ending.
You picked that one just because it agrees with your viewpoint.
I totally picked it for that reason. did you see the interview, Mr. Phillips?
I didn't see the interview, but I did see a transcript.
Yes.
And it was interesting because Buffett takes a very particular view, well, expresses his view very particularly. He doesn't say every crypto is terrible or everything's going to go badly. What he says is if he could short every single Bitcoin as a group, he thinks that he'd do very, very well. In other words, he believes the kind of broader, if you add them all together, there's a very good chance you'd lose money investing in all of them. Yep. Interestingly enough, he doesn't choose one or other of the coins and says this will be okay, the rest will be crap, or vice versa. Mm. Probably because he doesn't know and doesn't choose to know. And that was the other kind of cool quote from his interview, was he said, look, you know, it's hard enough to invest well in things I know about.
Yeah.
Why would I try and invest in something I know absolutely nothing about? So he's basically saying, look, he thinks there's enough speculation, enough hype, enough overvaluation in the Bitcoin world, the crypto world, that he would stay well away from all of it. But he doesn't try and pick winners or losers.
He also made a further comment as well that it wasn't, so he's obviously bearish on it, but he has no idea when it is going to happen or how it is going to happen or anything else like that.
And that's the thing. So he said that even though he believes this, he wouldn't short it because to short means to bet on it going down.
Yeah.
He's simply not sure enough either way. He thinks it'll go badly. But again, it's one of those things where it's outside his circle of competence. He just says, look, I don't know.
I think it's really smart too. I mean, again, some of us in this room have been bearish on Bitcoin for a while.
How's that going?
No names mentioned. And you know, how reckless would it have been to short it? Because, you know, a lot of the arguments that are made against Bitcoin and cryptos are as valid today as they ever were, but the price is, what, 4 or 5 times higher when some of those arguments were first made.
Mate, so it's still about tenfold since the beginning of last year.
You know? Yeah. So it is. There is one thing to sort of say, perhaps rationally, perhaps objectively, this thing is a little bit carried away, but when that worm turns is very, very, very difficult.
I'm pretty sure you just said, I'm right, but you can't stand to believe it. It's true.
So far is a little addition there.
All right. Now, there was another coin during the week that was announced.
Yeah. So, you know what? Here's talk about having your finger off the pulse here. I wasn't even aware that these guys were still around.
Who are these guys?
These guys are Kodak.
The photography company.
This is the, if anyone's ever done a business course anywhere ever, this is the business case study that comes up again and again and again. The multinational film giant that just sort of owned the industry. The company that invented the digital camera.
Right. So for anyone younger than us, Andrew, we need to be a little bit. There was a time when you took photos with a camera.
Yep.
You couldn't see what you took.
You had to stand really still.
Yeah.
And
you press the button.
And the guy got under the curtain.
No, not that old.
Sorry, right.
I'm not as old as you, dude.
Okay. So I want to know what happened there.
That's a whole different story. There was a time when you took your photos, you took them into the chemist, you had your film developed. It was developed on some Kodak film paper.
Yeah.
And given back to you. Kodak made $1 squillion selling film paper.
Yeah. Which is why they resisted the digital camera.
Right. So some bright spark at Kodak said, we can do this digitally. And they went, oh, that's a stupid idea.
We won't sell any film.
It'll wreck our business.
Yeah.
Not again. Not this time.
So
this time it's Kodak coin.
Now, okay. So let's
talk about leapfrogging from obsolescence to the bleeding edge.
It is really state of the art, supposedly. Anyway, yeah. So what they've done, and again, I'm not going to pretend to understand it well, but they've come up with a new platform here and a coin that is associated with that basically allow photographers and to manage their digital rights a lot better. So you can do this all through a blockchain platform and interact and trade through that using their cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
Interesting enough.
Probably, the share price of Kodak has tripled since the announcement.
Probably a valid technology. But that's where it's crazy, right? Now, again, talk about being old. I'm old enough to remember back in the late 90s when the tech boom was in full swing, we had...
Come on, you were 12 then.
That's right. Well, I still look 12 is the problem. I still get asked for ID.
Hashtag humblebrag. That's it.
Moisturize every night, mate. That's the key.
Let's not go there.
And we had all these mining companies and all these other... And all they would have to do is they would add .com to the end of their name and their share price would triple.
You know it.
And so Kodak... maybe cynically, maybe brilliantly, have added blockchain to the end of their name, and that's exactly what has happened again.
So here's the thing, I think this is the hard thing about blockchain, about cryptocurrencies, the whole thing is that there is a very decent technological basis for the use of a blockchain type technology for the sort of things Kodak are talking about, and it's very possible that Kodak still has enough cachet among photographers to carry that through and become some sort of standard when it comes to some sort of rights management, some sort of payment system, some sort of process. It's entirely possible. But like all of these things, putting the odds on this stuff is just incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Yeah, but the market is just happy enough with that word blockchain there.
So the Long Island Iced Tea Corporation changed its name to Long Blockchain Corp. And the shares tripled.
Oh, are you being serious?
Yeah, true.
Oh, I thought you were joking.
No, in December. Oh. And there was a biotech equipment company called Bioptics, changed its name to Riot Blockchain, and its shares doubled.
I'm going to have a word to the boss. I'm going to say Motley Fool Blockchain. Big fat bonus for that stroke of genius.
Full chain, there we go.
Full chain. Oh, man.
It's coming. Okay. You were asking me how much my Bitcoin was up, Andrew.
Was I? Oh, yes.
We cut that bit out of the recording.
Go on then.
Yeah, let him cut that bit. Well, I'm only up 145% today.
Is that all?
Yeah.
So what's the price in Aussie dollars?
$18,235.07.
How high did it get to?
Doesn't matter. Where it is now.
That's all right.
Get as little digs where he can.
Hey Matt. Ask Scott if you can sell.
let me press the sell button.
Why would you sell?
Hang on.
That's right.
No, let me press the button. Okay.
Sell.
No.
Oh, damn it.
This feature is not yet available in your country. Soon, very very soon.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
But we thought we'd use the opportunity to talk a little bit about the psychology of investing when it comes to Bitcoin.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to Matt in a moment to ask his thoughts. And just sort of, we need a circuit
breaker.
This is our
podcast,
we need someone
God
to sort of weigh in on who's right and who's wrong here. clue, I'm right. So, mate, we've touched on this fairly often because it's a pretty important topic, but a very quick intro on what is, it is fun too. What is a behavioral bias?
Yeah, so one of the great leaps forward in psychology, in economics, and then the combination of that we call behavioral finance or behavioral investing is the recognition that humans aren't as rational as we like to think. Mm. The economic models were built assuming perfect rationality. The market models were built the same way. And it wasn't until a couple of Israeli psychologists looked into this more and said, we think we're rational, but we can experiment and show where people make decisions they shouldn't make. Where rationally you would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. And yet the human brain is wired a certain way to make us do, think, or believe certain things.
It's amazing that that was an earth-shattering revelation. Like, yeah, it took us that long to realize that actually we're not these perfectly hyper-rational beings. When all evidence is to the contrary. Right.
Yeah. It's funny. One of the simple, and we won't get into this in detail, one of the simple tests that it was to give someone a cup, a mug, and then give someone some money and say, all right, how much are you going to pay for that mug?
Yeah.
Versus how much you would want if you have the mug, if you want to sell it. And the people who would buy the mug would routinely offer much, much less than the people who had the mug and were selling it.
I love it. One of my favorite biases.
Now, before they decided the experiment, neither had anything.
No.
So no one was losing anything. All of a sudden, because you have this mug, it's worth $7.
Yeah.
Those who didn't have the mug said it was worth $2. Yeah. It was the same mug.
This isn't a rare commodity, by the way.
Right, exactly.
I mean, this isn't something that very few people have. It's a coffee mug, right? Yeah. They give them away.
This is just a very simple example where just by owning something, the endowment effect they call it, by having it in your possession means you impute a larger or stronger, greater value to that thing than if you didn't have it in the first place.
And how would that relate to
Bitcoin?
Look, if someone held it, perhaps.
Hypothetically, if I'd had $243 worth of Bitcoin. What is it now? Probably changed since we started. Oh, $246 now.
Hey, easy money.
Hey, made some money. I don't want to answer that directly. I'm going to tell you a story, Andrew.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you a story. And it's kind of a story of where behavioral biases can impact our investing. This is, yes, it's about Bitcoin, but only because it's kind of an easy conversation to have. Mm. This is more about the journey of any investor in any asset class over time, and particularly for us in shares. Bitcoin's a bit of a sideline for us, although we talk about it all the time. It's just the journey, it's interesting itself, right? So when I was looking to, you know, do I don't I buy Bitcoin? How much do I know about it? I bought it in theory because I want to say, well, I want a bit of skin in the game. So part of this is exactly... So start the first behavioral bias. If you own something, you pay a lot more attention than if you don't.
Ain't that true?
And so for me, trying to learn about Bitcoin, the easiest way to kind of start following along and be engaged more in the process was simply to buy $100 worth. So it wasn't going to break the bank either way.
Yep.
It was just buying something. Great, I've got some. Now I start paying attention. I've got the app on the phone. Every couple of days, I'll have a look. Or if I think of it, I'll have a look.
Yeah.
When we come in here, I pull it up so I can give you a hard time. but largely other than that, it doesn't overly worry me. But but owning it now, I'm much more attuned to the price.
Yes.
So that's the first part of...
You're invested monetarily, but emotionally as well.
Now, again, rationally, you could be just as interested either way.
Yeah.
But you're not, behaviorally,
you're just
exactly.
not. You're just exactly. not. Yep. You will pay more attention to it than me because you've got some.
Then I try and think about how much money should I invest in this? And I'm like, well... It could be $10 or $100 or $1,000.
I bet you wish you did put $1,000.
Well, and that's the thing, right? So you start by saying, how much do I invest in this? Well, $100 feels like enough money, so I can afford to lose $100. Yeah. At that point, it was largely a, if not a straight out gamble, it was money I could afford to lose. Money I would take to the casino and say, I'll put $100 on the blackjack table. If I lose it all, no big deal. But then it starts to go up. And then you start to think, maybe I should have put more in this. I knew this was going to go up.
Yeah.
And so then you start that mind mess, I'll call it. Keep it PG. Of maybe I should have put more in this thing. It's going to go up. It's going to keep. If it keeps, if I put 10 grand, if I put 100 grand, and you start doing the maths, right? So 150% gain is nice.
Yeah.
But $100 doesn't matter. Yeah. Pay for lunch.
Yeah.
But you start to go, well, if that 1,000.
What are you having for lunch?
Well, I'm paying. Dude, you haven't lost your wallet. I'm buying you lunch.
That's true.
Not that much.
Quote unquote,
quietly
lost.
Well, yes. There is that.
Yeah, right.
So that's the, you know, you start to think about some of those behavioral biases. All of a sudden, it's like maybe I should have put more in. And then you get to a point where it goes up and up and up. And I was over $300 at one point from $100.
Yeah.
And now it's $250.
Mm.
And now I start to feel poor because I've lost some money.
Yeah.
Now, have I really lost the money? Had I really made it in the first place? That kind of anchoring then also starts to play in your mind. So,
and I'll give you one too that I've obviously got, which is the FOMO,
right?
Which is, you know, haha, it's what is so stupid. You do it, and now you're not the first person to do it. Like you're by far not the first person to do it.
Also not the last, by the
way. But you're the only guy I know in my sort of circle who has done it, and so now FOMO starts. Now it's like bugger, you know why? I didn't feel that bad about missing out until. You know, it's when your neighbor, there's nothing, who's the quote? One of you guys remind me, there's nothing more painful than watching your neighbors get rich.
Yeah.
And it's so true. And so like, well, maybe, you know, and the demons sort of come at night and you think, maybe I should do this because of the FOMO. Mm-hmm. Another
everyone else is getting rich.
Terrible behavioral bias.
Right.
Matt, We have talked way too long amongst ourselves
about Bitcoin.
Here. About Bitcoin. Well, we're not going to. Hey, steady. We're not moving beyond Bitcoin just yet.
About Bitcoin. What do you think about Bitcoin? Andrew's trying to say.
Yeah, I am. I'm going to ask you what you think about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to maybe if you could give us one of your a bias that you see at play in that space.
I'll give you my 1 week price prediction for Bitcoin.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Pens
at the ready.
I was about to buy then.
Scott's about to tackle.
I wasn't going to sell, but I was going to buy.
I wanted to four decimal places too.
So I really love investing in the share market because you get a combination of what I'd say like an objective reality of how well the company's doing and you get all the psychological stuff along with it. And so all the fun of investing in the stock market for me is buying those companies when they're well below what I think they're really worth, their true value.
Yep.
And that can happen because of all the psychology. The challenge when you're buying something like Bitcoin and
something wonderful like Bitcoin
and like gold is that it's almost purely psychology, right? So gold has a bit of other stuff, but Bitcoin's purely psychology, and it's another kind of level of difficulty, I guess, from terms of investing. So I'm definitely not writing it off. Like there's talk that Bitcoin could be the next gold, and if it is, then I think it's worth a lot more, probably like 100-fold up from where it is now. But it could also not be. Like gold's been around for tens of thousands of years as a store of value and everything else.
I'm going to interrupt very quickly. Let's say it does have a legitimate role in terms of a store of value. Even in that scenario, it wouldn't replace gold, right? Like it might take half of gold's market. There will always be, I would just due to the historical significance and the rest of it, that even under a very, very bullish scenario of store of value argument, that maybe it takes a third of gold's role.
I guess why not is the question.
Yeah, right? true.
Like there's no particular reason we need to value something that's shiny and that looks good and everything else. And it does have some advantages over gold. So
yes.
I guess that's a bullish argument. In fact,
I think Matt's saying we should buy Bitcoin. I think it's coming out on my side of the argument.
Let's move along. That's enough from that.
That'd be the last thing you ever hear from.
So I think it's tough to put much on. I like the mix that you get with shares of valuation and psychology.
Yep. So what behavioral bias would you say is sticks out for you when it comes to Bitcoin?
Oh, FOMO for sure.
FOMO.
Like I've heard
sure.
from very smart investors. Some might be
even not so smart.
Yeah, I think it's a big driver, right? And it's somewhat legitimate, I guess, because it is such a huge change. If it goes up 1,000-fold, you will look pretty silly,
right?
Maybe there's a case to make of just taking off that psychological edge of not missing out entirely. But I think that's clearly the biggest one. But it's all biases, I guess. It's all that we have to go on is psychology for it.
Yeah, makes it super tough. Now that's a nice segue.
I want Matt's call now. Who's right, Andrew or me? Come on.
What are we saying? Each side?
Bitcoin.
The best way to ask that is.
Oh, here we go.
This
is called framing. This is framing.
Another behavioral weakness here.
Change the topic.
A, do you own any kind of crypto?
Not what I asked.
And B, you planning?
That's not what I asked either.
I don't own crypto. I'm not planning immediately to, but I'm very interested in blockchain. So I'm very interested in what companies might be able to use the tech. Maybe not Kodak yet. I don't think they've done too much aside from announcing a name change, but yeah, very interested in the technology.
Okay. That's a nice neutral answer.
Come on. Are you long or short Bitcoin?
I'll take Buffett's stance on this one. I'm not long it, but I'm not going to short it either. Okay.
You sat right out of those splinters.
I'm taking that as a win for me.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
We actually got a really great tweet, actually a couple of weeks ago. We didn't have time to get to it, from Dr. Daniel Lewis. Twitter handle at Paths to Wellbeing, the number 2. And he made the point that you and I were talking a bit about Kogan not long ago, and we sort of said that I think it's overvalued, you think that it's undervalued. Mm-hmm. And he's basically sort of said, you know, can you walk me through some ideas? Like, give me some homework. How do I form my own independent opinion of value? It's a big reason why we had Matt on the show, because Matt is our valuation guru at the Motley Fool.
Resident valuation guru.
He does it better than anyone, and so this is a nice way to sort of hot potato that very difficult question right into Matt's lap and say, Matt, And let's start with shares. And then,
sure.
Andrew,
you know how I like to interrupt you. I'm going to do this one more time. And I'm going to do it only because you've done a great job introducing Matt.
Okay.
But you buried the lead dramatically.
I totally did.
So, yes, Matt is our valuation guru at The Fool. And, yes. and we lean on him for all things valuation. And he keeps us on the straight and narrow.
Yep.
It's also worth saying Matt is the portfolio manager for Motley Fool Pro.
Thank you.
And Pro's current return since inception is 153.3%. And the All Ords up 37.7%. So if you're taking a score at home, that's an outperformance of about 120-odd points, giving take some rounding. So
why are we having this guy on the show? Isn't it just making us look bad?
That's why we're holding as the expert, then we make sure he never comes back again. Matt is our valuation guru. He knows a lot of stuff, but he's also backing it up with performance. Yeah, those two things are important. Off, when it comes to our listeners saying, why would I listen to Matt? That's a pretty strong reason.
It's pretty good.
Thank you. Too kind.
All right, back with your question now.
Okay, so you're looking at a company, mm-hmm. and you've heard a couple of smart guys on this really cool podcast that you listen to every week, and they say that what's a good idea with investing is to come up with an independent idea of value that has got nothing to do with what the market price is. Where do you start?
Yeah,
that is a huge question. I know you could do a six-year course on that, but give us the best summary you can.
Yeah, so I guess my background was a very traditional kind of value investor. Mm-hmm. So crunching through all the numbers, digging through financial statements, all that good stuff. The trouble with traditional or kind of classical value investing, I think, is it tends to look at companies like they're going to die today and you kind of chop them up for what they're worth. So I kind of think about it like valuing a tree, right? Like the typical view looks at it, says it's about this high, it's this big, it's probably worth that much for its current timber.
Yep.
But the kind of growth value investing, this is what I've kind of merged towards, looks at that same tree and says, okay, that's actually, you know, a redwood tree. That's going to grow to be massive.
Yes.
We shouldn't just be valuing it what it's worth today. We should be thinking about what it's worth tomorrow. And all good investing should do this, but it's something that hasn't always got a lot of focus. So that's kind of where my starting point.
That's a fun analogy. I like that one. I haven't heard that before.
Cool.
I wrote an update on that last year.
I hadn't read it before.
Okay, fair enough.
Correct.
I just assumed that you hung on every word that I penned. Yeah. That's cool. That's cool.
You know what they say about assuming, don't they? Back to Matt.
Back to Matt.
So I think about companies in that way, that they're kind of dynamic, living in a dynamic kind of operating environment, that you should think about them like growing organic entities. And they carve out their own little niche, just like other organisms. And so you should be trying to value how big they're going to get. So that's the first point, is really understanding the business. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of work trying to understand what the business really does.
And when you say how big, are you talking things like sales and their earnings, you know, not necessarily to market share or something more abstract, but, you know, how does that translate back into cash flows?
So that's, you're getting towards the end there, I guess. The first point is just trying to make sure you understand the business itself. Yes. Is this business, the first question you'll be asking, is it going to be a much bigger business, more successful business in the future?
Can we hypothetically just use Kogan as an example, just to help our listeners kind of follow this process along?
Yep.
So let's use Kogan specifically. So you're going to look at Kogan. What questions are you asking? What's your mental process around understanding that business?
Yeah, so I'd be looking at its kind of position in the industry. Mm-hmm. So I'd like companies that are leaders. I think Kogan's probably a leader in Australia in online sales. That's something positive for it. Mm-hmm. Be looking at the industry itself. Is that industry growing or declining?
Mm-hmm. There's no real competitors in online retail. as far as I can tell.
So I'd be looking at that. I'd be looking at all the financials for the business itself. Mm. Just trying to get a real good handle on the business. Like normally I'd like to talk to the leadership of the company, get a handle if they're good or not. I particularly focus on small businesses, and in those cases I think leadership's even more important. I kind of think of it like you're the captain of a vessel, and if you're on a huge ocean liner, the captain can only do so much in a short bit of time to turn around.
Nice analogy.
If you're on a speedboat, a little company, then they can have a dramatic influence,
for good and for bad. Stealing that one.
Yeah, so a lot of things I look at there, just really trying to understand the business, and then you get to the next stages of, okay, how do I come to a number on this? And that is, as Andrew said, getting into forecasting the business itself and trying to forecast its cash flows.
So let's say you do that, and 10 different...
how do you do that?
Well, that's okay. Yeah, let's do that. How do you do that?
it's a really good question. There's 1,000 different ways to do it as well. So it's all about finding a method that works for you and suits your style. For me, it's about breaking down what are the drivers of the company and then forecasting those forward. So that has two purposes. One, it's very hard. I'm never going to nail it right on the dot. But the process of doing that for me is really helpful because it gets me to think about what are the drivers of this company. You know, what's going to drive its revenue? What's going to drive its costs?
Mm. Okay, so just take Scott's point. Talking about Kogan, these guys do online sales. So obviously, If they're selling more stuff,
yeah.
if they're moving into different categories, mm-hmm. that might be what you're thinking about in terms of how big the market is and what their share of that market, all of that kind of stuff. So you're sort of having a thumb suck, for want of a better word, on all of those things, and you'll spit out a number at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd be working down just through their profit and loss statement, trying to kind of...
Sales at the top, then costs.
A simplified version, something that I can get my head around without going into the weeds too far.
Yep.
And so it'd be, you know, what are the main line items for Kogan? So obviously retail sales. They've also got some new products around pet insurance, I think was the most recent thing. So that might be something if it was growing very fast. How are those going to grow? And how much are the costs going to grow as a relationship? And then coming back down to that bottom line of the cash flows. It sounds a lot more complicated than it is. It's basically just trying to get an idea of what the business does.
I think that's the point I'd argue as well. I see almost everyone in the industry sort of has that broad agreement, but then some people get lost in sort of spreadsheet land where you start mistaking your guesses.
Mm.
You can use the word forecast to make it sound more scientific, but guesses as fact.
Yep.
And you very easily arrive on these really precise numbers.
Mm.
And then you start treating that as reality. And that's, I think, that way danger lies. But to your point, it is more the exercise in trying to understand the dynamics of the business and having a ballpark. You don't have to, I think people get worried that they need to have a really accurate idea as to what Kogan's cash flows might be in 5 years' time. But it's really, you know, are we talking about sales growing at sort of mid-single digits or double digits, you know, that kind of thing. And where does that sort of land out? Okay. So we've done all of that.
Sorry, Matt's here as the expert,
Just trying to make myself sound smart. I'm trying to ride coattails here, Scott. Trying to impress my friends. And you just poured cold water all over it.
I think that's a worthy goal.
Worthy goal. Okay, step number two. So you've got cash flows. We've got a cash flow forecast for Kogan.
Yeah, so I guess the other point I'd make there, I do end up typically landing on one point, but I see that as being like one point within a cloud of future probabilities.
Yep. Error bars around it, perhaps.
Yeah, kind of to get philosophical about it. There's a lot of different ways this could play out. I don't think that it's even possible to predict one of them, but I just see that being kind of like the midpoint of where that could lie and constantly trying to change that over time. Some new news comes out. Is that better or worse? How does that shift things?
I'm going to interrupt you very quickly because that's what I do here. You mentioned cash flows a couple of times. Mm. Most of the listeners are thinking, what about profits?
Yeah.
Just a very quick version of why cash flow, not profit.
Yeah, I mean, the short version is that profits can be manipulated and they don't always represent the kind of true cash the business can generate. So there's a whole lot of accounting stuff that can happen. Some of it very good, but some of it can be bad. And so
Transurban, for example, reports almost no profit but does a truckload of cash flow.
That is a really good example because they are very smart at figuring out how to not pay taxes, perhaps.
That's a nice way to put it.
How to minimize their tax
legally inappropriately
in a completely legally inappropriate way. Mm-hmm. And so, that's a really shining example. You can obviously go the other way where companies report huge profits because a lot of people don't like to dig down in cash flows, then it can be a problem. So, both forms.
So, back to Andrew's question. Once you've got those cash flows, how do you turn it into a price you're prepared to pay?
Yeah, so it's predicting the next several years of that and then discounting those cash flows back to the future. So,
what are those going to be worth today? This is where I say to Andrew, Andrew, you do the Scott version of that.
Guy. Okay, let's discounting back.
Yeah.
Why and how?
Yeah. So, why is adjusting back?
So, if I've got a dollar of earnings in 2020, cash flow? Thank you. I've got a dollar. Well, why not call it a dollar?
Yeah. So, I guess the starting point, would you rather have $100 in 5 years' time or $100 today?
Ah.
And you're a very smart guy, Andrew. So, I know you're going to say $100 today
because
I can go and put that in the bank.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
And that money's going to grow. Plus, there's going to be inflation probably over time.
Yep.
So those are a couple of examples.
There is
a time value of money, exactly. And there's some risk that you're taking
in
the future. I might not actually give you that money, so you'd much rather have it today.
Yep.
That's the other component.
So you also want some reward for waiting, right? If I can't have the money today and spend it, I want some reward for waiting another 5 years to get the cash.
100%.
Opportunity cost.
And that's probably the biggest driver of it. You want some, exactly as Scott said, you want some reward for waiting. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to pull all those back to today. How much do I want to pay for that today, expecting that I'm going to get all these cash flows in the future?
So, and how would you discount that back? Is it that you say that I want sort of 10% each year for the risk and for waiting, or is it 5%? Is it 20%?
That's pretty much right. I think around 10% is the long-term return of the share market. Mm-hmm. So it's like a good starting point for the discount rate that we use.
You will hear discount rate bandied about.
It's exactly that. I imagine I'm going to buy the whole business today. I don't imagine I'm valuing a share. The whole business, I like to pretend I'm even bigger than I am.
Don't we all?
obviously, I'm not always doing that, but I imagine that I am. And then I'd take it over and then I would pay you know, $1 billion for this business, and I should get $3 billion worth back over the next 10 years, hypothetically. That would be a good investment for me.
Okay.
Because I'm buying it for a lot less than I think I'm going to get paid for it as it completes the course of its business and continues to grow and continues to reward shareholders.
And so I'm going to ask you one, probably last question, unless Andrew's got another burning one. You say 10% because that's kind of roughly what the market returns. Why would you want to use the market benchmark as your discount rate?
Yeah, so I guess it varies per company. Mm-hmm. So for a standard company, we'd be saying that it's about as risky as the rest of the market.
Right.
So that's kind of like a starting point. And then if a company is particularly more risky or those things are more uncertain, it might use a higher number or potentially a lower number, I guess, if the company is particularly safe. So
and broadly the market rate, because you could get the market return without
exactly risk. Right, Scott. So you don't need to take company risk. You could buy an index fund and get that market return. So that's kind of the starting point for that investment. I'm kind of getting onto maybe another topic, but then we try and put those together into a portfolio. And it's not just about one company, it's about how we can balance all those together. So some might be lower risk, and that allows us to take higher risk in other places.
I'm the Motley Fool's Director of Research, so I'm going to take a massive opportunity here for a shameless plug, because you mentioned putting them into a portfolio, and I can't help myself but mention that as you do run Motley Fool Pro, we are reopening Motley Fool Pro for new members. Come this weekend, the first emails will go out. Next week will be an opportunity to join Motley Fool Pro, only for members of other services. So if you're listening to this, you're a member of one of our other services, keep your eyes and ears open. You get a chance to hear some more from Matt, get a chance to have a little bit of a peek behind the curtain and sample some of those potentially significant returns that have been achieved in the past and I personally believe will be achieved in the future, though we should say there's no guarantees. Mm-hmm. That's the Motley Fool Pro story. If you're not a member yet, you can join one of our other services, Share Advisor that I run or Dividend Investor that Andrew runs, and get your invitation that way. So apologies for the shameless plug, but I couldn't help myself.
Nice one.
Kind of what I'm
here
for,
right? You've got to do it.
But seriously, look, yes, it's a shameless plug. The beauty of working in the Motley Fools, we get to sell products that we actually believe in. Those sort of returns that Matt's delivered for members of Motley Fool Pro are just staggeringly impressive. So, if there's anything more worth selling than a service that does that sort of return, I don't know what is.
Yeah, for sure.
I would hardly recommend
it's mine,
look
of
at
course,
it.
Which goes without saying.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
So anyway, let's wrap this up. We have just tackled a huge topic, and Matt, you've done an excellent job of summarizing that very neatly. As always, we would invite more questions if people would like any clarification. Mm-hmm. If you'd like to pick into a particular area of that, we are more than certainly happy to do that kind of stuff.
How can people get in touch with us, Andrew?
They can get in touch with us. We think Twitter, I think, is the best
Twitter's
way
the best
of
way to
doing
do
that. We're all about social media these days, being young and hip as we are.
All the cool kids. We haven't quite made it to Instagram yet, though.
No.
We're not that cool.
Let's face it.
The Motley Fool.
What? What's that?
We'll talk about that later. The Motley Fool AU is our Twitter handle. You can email us at info@fool.com.au if you want to. And our fantastic member services fools will be able to pass those on. But The Motley Fool AU is the best Twitter handle to throw us your questions, comments, feedback.
Yep.
If you want to hear more from Matt, let us know. We will delete those tweets because it makes Andrew and I feel bad. But if you like what Andrew and I are doing, please tell us and we'll mention it on the podcast next week.
That is awesome. Thank you very much, Scott, as always.
Thank you, Andrew.
And
thank
Matthew,
you,
thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can subscribe to the MMM Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app.
And you should.
Man, we've got to mix this up, don't we? Every single week.
People would be disappointed if we didn't.
Really?
Okay. Well, I would.
Well, can I just record it once and then just play it at the end?
It's different. It's fresh. We do this sort of stuff. The interplay like this makes it sound fresher.
Totally worth
it. So people listen and go, oh, that's really interesting. The guys
are
great.
Totally worth it.
These guys are fantastic.
And if you'd like to see a little bit more, you can always go to fool.com.au/MMM. That's the one. Until next week, fool on.
Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.